This is not a test. This is not a test. Please remain calm.
Unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims.
Seeking human victims. Seeking human victims.
Saga of Dracula moves forward to yet another decade. We saw the original Christopher Lee Dracula, the horror of Dracula in the 50s, and the 60s saw a few sequels. We talked about Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, 1968. There's also Dracula Prince of Darkness in the 60s. And then now to the 70s with another Dracula movie. This time a sequel to Dracula AD, Dracula 1972 AD. We're talking about the Satanic Rites of Dracula from 1973. This is the sequel to Dracula AD 1972, which we did not cover, but you can go watch for yourself. I think one Dracula in the 70s movie is really all we need. But it is the 70s. The music is popping. The bushes are aplenty. It's definitely Hammer Dracula in the 70s, which is a strange, strange combination. So welcome to yet another episode of Seeking Human Victims, Season 18, The Vampires of Hammer. I am your host, the devil you know, the original motherfucker, and the high priest of the Coven of the Goat, the Rev Dan Wilson. And I am here with my satanic cult. Hey, Dreamboat Annie.
Evil begets evil. There is an unholy aura in this place, and it is not a question of a little occultism or a touch of mysticism, Mr. Wilson. It's vampirism.
Hell yeah, brother. And also rounding out the show tonight, and back on the show always, glad to have him, the Jackal of Carlsberg, Big Daddy Grizz, Jason Grizzle.
This particular evil is more potent and more addictive than heroin, I assure you. And the end result is just as fatal.
Damn it to hell, I was hoping we were going to get a Peter Cushing. And he did not disappoint. This a film I have seen a couple times, but, you know, again, in the marathons on Halloween, it's like 4 a.m. You're about four beers in when this one comes on. Like, I don't think I'd ever, like, sat down and watched it start to finish, but I've definitely seen many scenes from this movie many times, particularly the opening. But you know, this was like the most like involved, thorough watch I had given it, and that's my experience.
I of course have no experience with this movie prior to this watch.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I've never seen a whiff of this film. No late night cable, no Showtime, no nothing. So first time for me.
All right. So what's it going to be like to see the mighty Dracula, who was, you know, these Christopher Lee vampire movies, you think, oh, they don't have any new stories to tell, but, you know, they've all been pretty entertaining. And so we're up here now with kind of a new spin on it and a new decade. The story actually brings us to modern times. So, you know, in the 50s, we're in like fucking gothic times, you know, like probably what, 1600s, 1700s, you know, Dracula times. Fucking and we're still in olden times in most of the sequels. So this is really with AD 1972, the movie before this is the one that really brings them into the quote unquote modern era, or what would have been for when the films came out. So I'm excited to dig into this one for sure. But before we do that, we've got to bring you our musical guest, represented by our pals at Horror Pain Gore Death Productions. That's horrorpaingoredeath.com. And our pal Mike Giuliano over there, always hooking up the best metal jams for the Seeking Human Victims musical guests and so many other things. And Grizz is going to tell you about our musical guest tonight.
Horror Pain Gore Death Productions welcome Corpse Vor to the roster with a debut release, Feed the Plague. Hailing from France, Corpse Vor formed in 2022 as the brutal brainchild from Doomster's Wintervere's lead guitar player. Feed the Plague unleashes 10 tracks of pummeling, grinding death metal that reeks of misanthropy and disgust for all animal suffering. Corpse Vor bring the pure old-school intensity of classic death grind, melded with furious modern energy and fueled by extreme aggression. For fans of Brutal Truth, Cannibal Corpse, Carcass, Cattle Decapitation, Disrupt, Drop Dead, Mass Extinction, Napalm Death, Nauseam, and Terrorizer, here's Corpse Vor with Feed the Plague.
So this is the 8th film in the Hammer Dracula series. We've not covered all 8. This is the 4th one we've covered. Can you believe we're already 4 episodes in? But let's just recap real quick, shall we? Right? So we had 1958 Dracula, 1960 The Brides of Dracula. We did not cover that film. That is actually a great fucking movie. You should go check that out. Dracula Prince of Darkness, 1966, we did not cover either, but also a pretty cool flick. Then we had Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, 1968, we did cover that. And then there was actually Taste the Blood of Dracula from 1970. So actually, okay, I stand corrected. We started in the 70s, but these movies were not like taking place in the 70s, to be clear. Taste the Blood of Dracula from 1970. We had Scars of Dracula from 1970. We had Dracula AD 1972, which I mentioned. And then, of course, this film, the final Christopher Lee starring Dracula film, The Satanic Rites of Dracula from 1973. And there was one more movie in the series after Christopher Lee left. It was The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires from 1974. And Peter Cushing does return for that one. So Peter, they got Cushing back for one more, but they couldn't get Lee back. This is his fond farewell. We will not be covering the Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, to be clear. So let's talk about this again, the eighth film in the Dracula, seventh and final one for Christopher Lee. The third film to unite Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. Only Dracula and Dracula AD 1972, contrary to popular belief, had those two together. So the general plot, I'm going to go over this because it was convoluted as hell and hard to follow. And there was a lot of shit going on and way too many fucking actors. So in 1974, we have a Secret Service agent who barely escapes this satanic ritual. It's being held on the English countryside. And he dies of his wounds. But before he does, he reveals that the cabal, if you will, is composed of four very prominent members of society. You have a minister, a peer, a general, and a famous scientist, led by this Chinese lady named Chen Yang. And photos of the four dignitaries taken by the agent are developed. And a fifth photo, apparently showing an empty doorway, is assumed to be a mistake. We learn it isn't. But in order to avoid any reprisals by the minister, the Secret Service official Colonel Matthews calls in Scotland Yard's Inspector Murray to work on the case independently. And Murray suggests consulting a noted occult expert, none other than Professor Lorimer Van Helsing, played by Peter Cushing. And the cult kidnaps the Secret Service secretary, Jane, who's bitten by Count Dracula. Murray, Secret Service Agent Torrance, and Van Helsing's granddaughter, Jessica, who's just hanging out, they arrive at the country house and separate. Murray and Torrance investigate inside the house where they meet Chen Yang. Jessica enters the house through the cellar where she finds Jane chained to a wall and she's revealed to be a vampire. There's a crazy commotion. They attempt to feed on Van Helsing's granddaughter, but she gets rescued. They kill Jane. And they escape. Meanwhile, so there's this going on. And then meanwhile, Van Helsing visits his scientist friend, Julian Keeley, who he recognized among the four conspirators. And Keeley's apparently involved in this bacteriological research that's designed to create a virulent strain of the bubonic plague. Van Helsing is shot by a guard and he passes out. And when he revives, Keeley's dead body is hanging from the ceiling with the most fucking hilarious death face in the history of cinema.
Yeah, that shit was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we had to run the movie back at one point because it messed up on us and like closed it out and started it back over from the beginning. And we got to watch it again and we laughed just as hard the second time.
Yeah, hats off to Freddie Jones. You might know him as Yenir from Crawl, but yeah, this was before he was gray-headed and distinguished-looking, and this was certainly not a distinguished death scene for him.
No, not at all. But also, when Van Helsing wakes up, the plague is gone. So we have an end-of-the-world plague plus Dracula plus a satanic cult. Like, it's getting hairy.
Speaking of hairy, don't leave out the film opens with a nude sacrifice. First of a cockerel, then of the young maiden. So,
yeah, that's the striking imagery that makes you think, oh, this movie's going to be pretty cool. And then it happens. But it starts off strong.
Not too strong. I mean, the girl's kind of small-chested. You know, from here on out, they'll be referred to as Britties, you know, or British titties, if
God damn it, so desire. Oh, shit.
You heard it here, folks. Pretties.
Keeley refers to the 23rd of the month, which Van Helsing discovers is the Sabbath of the Undead. Keeley's research notes lead Van Helsing to the reclusive property developer, D.D. Denham. Every time he said the name D.D. Denham, I chuckled for some reason. That's who funded the research, of course. Van Helsing speculates that the fifth photo of the empty doorway might actually be Dracula, because he cannot be captured on camera. He thinks that Dracula finally wants to die, but in his evil will want to destroy all of humanity with him. Van Helsing visits Denham in his headquarters, built on the churchyard where Dracula died in the previous film, and discovers that he is actually Dracula. He tries to shoot Dracula with a silver bullet, but he's beaten by the Count's conspirators. He decides that killing Van Helsing would be too simple, and has him moved to the country house. Jessica, Murray, Matthews, and Torrance, while observing the country house, are attacked by snipers. Torrance and Matthews are killed, and Murray and Jessica are captured. Murray awakens in the cellar and escapes the clutches of Chin Yang, who has been revealed to be a vampire herself. After staking her through the heart with a mallet, he destroys the other female vampires with the clear running water from the sprinkler system.
Also, I just want to take a second to point out when it says that he is, when he tries to shoot Dracula with a silver bullet and is, quote, beaten by the Count's conspirators. That motherfucker was just shoved slightly.
And he crumbled.
He's like 806 years old.
This is true. There was some real Mr. Burns offense going on from all sides in this movie. Dracula arrives at the house with Van Helsing and announces to his henchmen that Jessica will be his consort, uncorrupted by the plague that his four horsemen will carry out into the world. That includes Van Helsing. The conspirators, who had considered the plague a threat not to be used, begin to question their master. Dracula's hypnotic command brings him back under control. He commands John Porter to break the vial, releasing the bacteria and immediately infecting the minister. Murray overpowers the guard in the room. The guard's metal baton smashes a computer panel, causing an explosion that starts a fire and unlocks the ritual room. The uninfected conspirators escape. Murray rescues Jessica, and the infected minister and the plague bacteria burn in the fire. Dracula attacks Van Helsing, but his prey escapes through a window in the woods. Van Helsing lures Dracula into a hawthorn bush where he is entangled, and Van Helsing grabs a fence post and drives it through his heart. Dracula disintegrates into ashes, and Van Helsing retrieves the Count's ring. And normally, you know, since the days of the burial plot, we really haven't gone over the plot on the show, but this one was so goddamn all over the place, I just had to fucking read it out loud so you could hear how it sounded being read aloud.
It was just as ridiculous to watch it in movie form.
Yeah, see, this is before Dracula could just, like, appear in front of you and be really fast. This is, like, two old British men literally running after each other through the woods, and it takes a long time.
So, this one is directed by Alan Gibson, who was actually a Canadian director who was pretty active over in the British film and TV scene. He directed Journey to Midnight in 1968, Crescendo in 1970, of course, this film, Checkered Flag or Crash in 1977, Witness for the Prosecution in 1982, and A Woman Called Golda in 1982, starring Ingrid Bergman. TV work included Ed Joe from 1965, The Compone Investment from 1974, Churchill and the Generals from 1979, and The Charmer from 1987. And I mean, this movie had some style. That's about all it had going for it. The copy that they had on what did we watch this on? Plex. The copy that they had on there, the quality was just fucking atrocious. I don't know if this is the best quality they had. Certainly was not like the restored 4K version there. That was like a version they fucking barely scraped together and duplicated off of like a fucking 60-year-old reel or some shit. Like, I mean, it was in bad shape.
Yeah, it was very, very rough. And but I was gonna say the coloring was off, but I don't know if that's the copy's fault or that's just what it looked like.
I tried two versions, one on Tubi and one on Roku, and both looked pretty rough, but the one on Roku looked a little bit better.
Yeah, I think that's the more complete version. We'll talk more about that in a moment. And then the music was done by John Kaskavas, a Greek-born composer who worked on numerous British films and TV shows in the 60s and 70s. The score is a blend of orchestral horror elements, funk, and rock, reflecting the film's blend of gothic chills and modern sensibilities. And the music is in part what gives it a lot of that style. I mean, it's really got a funky 70s, almost like a blaxploitation film soundtrack at times. And then, you know, it kind of switches over to the gothic, more Dracula-sounding, stringy, bombastic score at times as well. So I think the music was one of the stronger points of this.
Definitely agree. It really stands out. And otherwise, I mean, that and all the track lighting from the 70s both stand out about this film. But, you know, otherwise, I couldn't really tell you much else of what was going on. But definitely a plus in the soundtrack, you know, just getting away from the orchestral parts, which are cool. But, you know, Dracula getting down with a little funk, I think that's what was needed at the time.
And the special effects were done by Eddie Fowley, who was the special effects artist on the film. He did the practical effect, the prosthetics, the makeup, and the gore. He also did Dracula 80, 1972, and more famously, The Wicker Man. Movie we still haven't covered on this show. We're going to have to at some point. One of the all-time greats that we have somehow not yet come across on Seeking Human Victims. We're going to get there. And then we had Tom Smith, who was responsible for the miniature effects, including the miniature of Dracula's castle used in the final showdown. He was a veteran British effects artist who worked on many James Bond titles. They also used the Albert Westmore Company, a famous makeup company, who did some of the prosthetics and wigs, and George Lucas and Associates. Yes, before founding Lucasfilm, he worked just on some small special effects in various capacities for different movies, including this one. His contributions are believed to involve some of the stop motion animation and optical effects. And it would almost be a great pitch for the auditorium if it wasn't time to tell you about the cast. The cast, of course, we already mentioned Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing back again. You can go back many episodes and hear their background. Two of the all-time greats. No dispute there. Christopher Lee's portrayal of Dracula in this does seem pretty tired. He's like, I'm fucking over this shit. And you can see it on his face. Peter Cushing is less, you know, he seemed to be less temperamental and, you know, emotional about the role. And he was always just a pro. You know, but he didn't have to do as many as Christopher Lee either. You look, Christopher Lee was in almost every fucking one of these. Peter Cushing missed out on a bunch of them. They're in the middle, especially. Like, I love Christopher Lee's portrayal of Dracula, generally. I have stated many times this season that I think it is the greatest portrayal of Dracula overall, by far. But I just think in this movie, he's just so fucking done with it. And it turns out that that is the case, because it's the last one that he does.
Yeah, I mean, it's been at least, what was it, just since the last time he worked with Peter Cushing as Van Helsing, it's been over 20 years.
Yeah, he's had enough of this shit.
That's a long time to play a character.
And then we had Michael Coles as Inspector Murray, who's the famous British actor known for shows like The Avengers and Doctor Who. Let me tell you something. If you didn't do The Avengers or Doctor Who, then you wasn't shit if you were a British actor, because the who's who of folks are always on those shows, it seems. And then we had William Franklin as Peter Torrance, also another famous British actor with a long career in TV and film. We had Richard Vernon as Colonel Matthews, also a famous British actor with a long career in TV and film. We had Joanna Lumley as Jessica Van Helsing, a British actress, also a comedian. She was in Absolutely Fabulous and The New Avengers. Wait a minute. Is that the fucking redheaded lady from Ab Fab?
She was the blonde on Ab Fab.
I was going to say, she's the blonde one.
Okay. But wow, holy shit. I had no idea.
Yep, she's Patsy.
A longtime British institution, Joanne Lumley. And Valerie Van Oost as Jane. We had Barbara Yu Ling as Chin Yang. She was a famed British actress of Chinese descent, known for her roles in films like Enter the Dragon and Shanghai Surprise. And then we had a lot of people in this movie, but the last one we're going to talk about is Freddie Jones, who played Dr. Julian Keeley, who had an extensive career in television, theater, and cinema. In theater, he was known for originating the role of Sir in The Dresser. He was also the Showman Bites in The Elephant Man in 1980, and he was best known for playing Sandy Thomas in the British ITV soap opera Emmerdale from 2005 to 2018. Did you also say he was in Krull?
Yes, he was the old one, Ynir. You might also remember him as the Mentat in Dune. I mean, this guy's been on everything. Pretty much any time of day you get on the TV, British or American films, you can see a Freddie Jones movie.
Well, there you go. I thought he was pretty entertaining in this. Of course, we already mentioned the crazy death face. But that is your cast. It's extensive. There's even more players, but we're going to be here all night if we sit here and talk about all the damn CIA agents or MI-13, I guess, agents and the fucking spies and what have you. This movie was something else. Look.
It's basically three different casts because there's three different storylines happening.
Let's talk about the shooting dates and locations. It was shot from January 8th to March 3rd of 1973, primarily on Elstree Studios in Borehamwood, England. There was some on-location shooting as well in Notting Hill, Bucketts Island, South Kensington, London, Queensgate Lodge in London, and the majority of the film, though, was shot at Elstree Studios. As mentioned, that was a historic facility that housed a number of classic British productions, on-location filming, mostly confined to London and the surrounding areas. It was to add a touch of realism to the Gothic atmosphere.
That's an odd and interesting fact.
And with it, let's open the door to the auditorium.
Strange truths and morbid curiosities will be revealed inside the auditorium.
As an in-joke, Dracula's lair was named Pelham House, which is a reference to retiring James Carrera's house at Pelham Place in London. Dracula poses as a multimillionaire who's never seen in public and never photographed. A 1970s audience would inevitably have been reminded him of the eccentric and reclusive Howard Hughes. Funny how they tried to place him, you know, in the modern time.
I think there's also a great social commentary there that he's got control over, you know, chemical corporations and oil companies and so many other things, you know, noting that the billionaires who control these things are going to destroy the world sooner or later.
Just as silly as this movie is, they're trying to throw in a little statement to say a little something there, which is pretty funny.
Which is apparently stab billionaires in the heart.
Christopher Lee was pretty much over it by this point. He had some kind of negative things to say about having to do this. He found himself getting increasingly dismayed and disillusioned that the portrayal was moving away from the source material. He said this was a mix of Howard Hughes and Dr. No. And despite him being killed at the end of the last film, Dracula has already been resurrected. Unlike the previous films, this is not shown on screen, nor are any details given for how it occurred.
They're just like, I mean, we couldn't come up with anything different this time. Just, I don't know, you pick.
This was the final Hammer film of one John Harvey. Peter Cushing and Freddie Jones had previously worked on another Hammer film together in 1969's Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. And the film takes place in November of 1974 Dracula does not make his first appearance until 31 minutes into the film. You are wondering for a minute, how the fuck does this tie into Dracula?
Yeah, it's very much like a cult film. Like, oh, yep, this is going to be a movie about satanic cult for a while. Like, you almost forget that it's supposed to be a Dracula movie.
The alternate title was Count Dracula and His Vampire Bride. That was for a much more heavily edited version that aired in the United States. In England, it was indeed The Satanic Rites of Dracula. The role of Jessica is actually a recasting. It was originally played by Stephanie Beecham in Dracula AD 1972. The original working title, so, you know, we mentioned the alternate title for the States, Dracula and His Vampire Bride, which is the version you could see on Tubi, actually. The working title for this was Dracula is Dead and, well, Living in London, a reference to the stage and film musical reveal Jacques Brel is alive and well and living in Paris. Christopher Lee was not amused by this. Speaking at a 1973 press conference announcing the feature, he said, "I am doing it under protest. I think it is fatuous. I can think of 20 adjectives. Fatuous, pointless, absurd. It's not a comedy, but it's got a comic title. I don't see the point."
But he did see the check.
That he did. The movie was eventually retitled, but it was still marketed in France as Dracula is still living in London. Movie historian Jonathan Rigby observed that the feature wrapped on January 3rd, 1973, which was 15 years to the date, after Dracula, the first film in the Hammer series, finished shooting. Actually, 25 years. I think that's a typo. This was the last Hammer movie that Lee and Cushing would make together, although they would reunite one final time 10 years later for House of the Long Shadows. Not a Hammer movie. Probably Amicus. I'm going to look. Oh, no, this is a 1983 fucking canon movie. Okay. We're trying to recreate some of that classic British horror. Wasn't released in the U.S. till 1979 when it was released as Count Dracula and His Vampire Bride. This also appears to be the first example of a silver bullet being used against a vampire in film. And then finally, the character of Jessica has been played in each Hammer Dracula film by an actress who also portrays a character romantically linked to Ken Barlow on the movie Coronation Street in 1960. That is truly an odd and interesting fact. And we'll close the door on the auditorium with that. But let's see how this one did. Let's look at the numbers!
Numbers of the Beast.
Of Dracula. So, unfortunately, no one knows the exact budget for the Satanic Rites of Dracula, as they're not publicly available.
You need to start over. You started talking before it started recording.
Yeah.
Okay, ready?
Okay, I'll cut it.
Cool. All right, Numbers of the Beast. So, unfortunately, the exact budget for the Satanic Rites of Dracula isn't publicly available, but estimates range anywhere from £250,000 to £400,000. Which was a modest budget for Hammer Films at the time. So the box office didn't fare too well at about £223,450. That's about $542,000 in 1974, adjusted for inflation. And worldwide, it fared a bit better with an estimated total earnings of around $1 million. So I wouldn't call it a smashing success, but they appeared to have gotten their money back on it.
It was the last little bit of air was getting squeezed out of the balloon here, it seems. Allmovie.com called it the least interesting film in the Dracula Hammer series. Time Out wrote that there was a lot of weak action and weaker lines, but a vast improvement on Dracula AD 1972, which hilariously, we only picked this one. One, because the title is cool and kind of on brand with me. But then also, it was the only one that was free on streaming. So, you know, we're going with the nice price when we can. And so, we didn't watch Dracula AD 1972. guess we made the right choice. And the critical consensus is that it's fun and campy with some unique elements, but it's you have to approach it like with a B movie appreciation and forgive its flaws if you want to like it, really. They say critical reception is divided, with praise for the entertaining aspects balanced with criticisms of the weak plot, dated effects, and underutilized characters. Whether you like it or find it laughable, it's a cult film, and it's definitely had some influence out there in its time. But yeah, that's the skinny on the Satanic Rites of Dracula. What legacy does it have? I mean, we already said it. It was Christopher Lee's last fucking Hammer Dracula movie. So that's the big part of its legacy. If you want to own this one in your collection, then Andy can tell you how.
Yeah, so it was released in the UK by CIC Video in 1983. This is VHS, of course. And in the US by Vestron Video in 1983 as well. It was re-released in the UK by Fox Lorber Video in 93. And in 94 in the US by Brentwood Home Video. It was released on Laserdisc one time in the United States by MCA/Universal, and that was in 1984. As far as DVDs go, it was first released in the UK by Anchor Bay in 2000. It was released in the US for the first time by Image Entertainment. And then in the UK, we had Optimum releasing in 2004 as part of a Hammer Horror double feature with, of course, Dracula AD 1972. And then it was actually re-released in 2005 in the US as part of a different double feature with Scars of Dracula. And then it was released in Germany by Studio Canal in 2008 as part of a Christopher Lee Collection box set. And then it was released in Australia by Shock Entertainment in 2010. As far as Blu-rays go, it was first released in the UK by Studio Canal in 2014 and released in the US by Warner Brothers in 2015 and then again in 2018 as part of the Hammer Horror Icons Collection box set in the UK. You can buy or rent it across varying platforms, but it is free with ads on, as mentioned multiple times throughout this episode by all three of us, because none of us paid for that, Tubi, Roku Channel, and Plex. And all of those are going to be, of course, with ads. And then the Tubi version is, I believe, is the Dracula and His Brides.
Yes, Dracula and His Vampire Bride.
And it's edited, and it's not the same as the one on Plex and Roku.
The differences are probably negligible, but I didn't look. When in doubt, watch the less edited version. Always. All right, well, that closes the coffin on Dracula and His Satanic Rites. Only thing left to give is our final motherfucking thoughts on the Satanic Rites of Dracula. Man, I love everything that this movie is in theory. I love fucking sleazy 70s movies. I love Dracula. I love, racy elements, nudity, satanic cults, conspiracies, like end of the world plots, like all that kind of shit is great. But all together, I don't know, like it didn't really work. It was kind of a sad thing to see how the mighty had fallen with Christopher Lee's Dracula being my favorite Dracula, and what a great performance he had in some of the other movies that we had covered. And then, of course, in this one, you can just, like I said earlier, you can just tell he's fucking over it, and he's ready to hang up the cape And it's just rough. And like, it didn't help that the quality of it was really bad. But you go from these elegant, big, bombastic sets and these beautiful looking Terrence Fisher movies to this. And it's a fucking crying shame. Like, the coolest title of all the Dracula movies brought the shittiest one.
Yeah. There was some funny lines and silliness and fun moments in this movie. The soundtrack was pretty decent, quite good. The visuals, great. There was some great visuals. What the hell was this movie? So many half-baked ideas that they shoehorned into the same movie to try to make them connected in one way or another. And it's just, they had an idea, kind of. And I think they were just trying to get across the finish line at that point. And that's okay. But, yeah, I can't say I would ever watch this one again. You know, it wasn't the worst thing I've ever seen.
I like that. And that's okay. Yeah, I feel like what they were doing here is maybe, you know, Wilson kind of hit upon it, but I feel like maybe they were borrowing, like, everybody had, like, some kind of half-baked script. So it's like, oh, this billionaire is going to destroy the world with bubonic plague, or, you know, by the early to mid-70s, the New Age and satanic cults are kind of starting to become more prominent in the public consciousness, for better or worse. Yeah. Not a whole lot of coherence to this, but you know, you have to give it to the British actors. British actors will always show up and play it completely straight and do it right. So, you know, that's the coherent part, I guess, is that everybody was trying to turn in some kind of performance, but this is kind of a convoluted mess. You know, it had some saving graces like the funk elements. You know, maybe they should have gone all funk and called it like Get Back Drac. I don't know. But that's not much more you can say. I don't know that it's one I would say, oh, if you're going to do a Dracula marathon, you know, this one has to be thrown in. As, you know, we can see, you know, as I've pointed out several times in later vampire films, you can say, oh, I wonder if they got that element from, you know, Horror of Dracula or, you know, some of the other earlier Hammer films. And, you know, you can see the influence, but I can't see, is anybody looking at this and saying, you know, this was Hammer's artistic peak. So that's about where I could leave it. I don't have much more to say because it's not that much of a movie.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the funk being the best thing. I Get Back Drac popped the shit out of me. You know, what if they did fucking Dracula versus Blackula? That would have been great.
That would be their opening day.
Like we did cover one of the Blackula movies on here. Scream, Blackula, Scream. That and the original are both fucking fantastic movies.
Some of my favorites, definitely.
All right, so next week we'll be back with another vampire film, this time not in the universe of Dracula, but a Hammer vampire film nonetheless. We're going to go to 1963's Kiss of the Vampire next week on Seeking Human Victims.
This is not a test. This is not a test. Please remain calm.
Unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims.
Seeking human victims.
Product of One Good Scare Productions. It is written, edited, researched, and directed by Dan Wilson, with assistance by Fuji Grant and Annie Wilson. Original music is provided by Shreddiford, as well as KT Grant. All other music and audio clips are property of their respective editors.